You're listening to In Focus on 107.7 The Wolf. I'm John Dampschroeder, and my guest today is Congresswoman Marcy Kaptur, the longest-serving woman in the history of the United States House of Representatives. When Congresswoman Kaptur's 19th term ends next year, she will have 38 years representing Toledo in the U.S. House. Congresswoman, so much about our society has changed since you first took the oath of office in January of 1983. How have things changed in the institution of Congress over that time?
I would say, first of all, thank you very much, John, for allowing me to speak with you and
our
listening audience. It's a great pleasure to be here today. Let me just say that when I was first elected, there was a speaker from the state of Massachusetts whose name was Tip O'Neill. And Tip would just wander around the floor of Congress. He would eat his tomatoes and lettuce over in the cloakroom where members could just approach him. It was a very collegial body. He and the Republican leader, whose name was Bob Michael, used to sing at the end of the year to the President of the United States, "We wish you a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year." And though there were partisan differences, they were never acid. I would say one of the things that's changed a lot, and it happened starting during the 1990s, is feelings got very harsh between members on both sides of the aisle. And then people began not liking serving in the Congress, and so you had a lot of people leaving. In a way, you could say it was a generational change, but the seniority of members became much less. And Congress became broadcast electronically and visually. Tip said back in the 80s, he said, "You know, I know we have to do this, but everything's going to change." And so today you see members going down to the floor and really performing for the cameras, and the cameras don't come to the committee rooms, which is where most of the work is done. So you have a more a stage-like institution that people perform publicly, but it isn't the kind of institution that used to exist where you would actually conduct business on the floor with other members. You had a chance to talk without all of this, these eyes and ears of the media, and so it's more open, but it's less productive. It's very interesting, and sometimes I get discouraged. You know, I go, gosh, here I'm in my committee. We've worked so hard. This is so important to the country. And there's not a single media person representing us because you know why, being present there? Because it's boring. Some of the work is really boring, but it has to be done for the country. But it's not mediagenic. So I would say that's changed a lot. I think also the pressure on members to raise money for the next campaign is crushing. And it's in both parties, and it's expected. And what's happened is the political institutions have moved inside the Congress rather than the political parties handling the fundraising on the outside through the Republican and Democratic parties or whatever parties might exist. That is a huge downdraft. And the average seniority now is under 6 years, so people come that they don't have grounding. They don't spend the time that it takes to do something great for the country. When I introduced the bill for building the World War II Memorial, I thought that would happen very quickly. It took us 17 years. 17 years. So there's, I think, a lack of realism about what it takes to do something of significance for the country. So those would be some of the changes that I see.
Your current district, which stretches from Toledo in the west to Cleveland in the east, taking in all of that Lake Erie coastal community along the points in between, has been used as evidence of gerrymandering in federal court. Now, I'm going to come back to the issue of politicians picking their voters instead of voters picking their leaders. But first, I want to examine the unintended consequence of making you a singular voice on Ohio's most vital natural resource. Isn't that really a positive for you?
It's a positive for me. In fact, they call me Lady of the Lakes. And it unites us from Cleveland all the way west through Toledo. But it also diminishes the voice of the lake in a way. We have Congressman Joyce from northeastern Ohio, from Ashtabula, a gentleman on the other side of the aisle. He and I work very hard for Lake Erie, but it used to be we would have upwards of four representatives or five from the Lakes region. So you don't have this kind of numbers that we used to. And as you get away from the lake, most members from Ohio don't claim the lake as an interest. If you look at Ohio as a whole, from about Findlay south, south of Findlay, that drains to the Ohio River and then the Mississippi. Our area here that's along the rim of the lake drains into Lake Erie and the Great Lakes. So we're in a very different universe, a very different watershed than the rest of the state of Ohio. And I have to be honest, most governors don't pay much attention up here. Most lieutenant governors, most state elected officials, they don't pay a lot of attention to this watershed. So it's a real heavy lift.
You know, that's really shocking because 3 million people get their drinking water from Lake Erie. 30% of the travel and tourism spending in the state of Ohio comes from Lake Erie. And it faces huge threats from farm runoff and invasive fish species. But there are gigantic opportunities through restoration, estimated to add over $100 billion to property values along the lake. What has the most impact in Washington, the threat or the opportunity?
I would say right now the threat, because of the changing nature of our environment. We've had a 124-year high in terms of rainfall in the country between the Rockies and the Appalachians. And we can see the impact. The Great Lakes, Lake Erie's higher. It's at a 124-year high. I won't go into all the outfall from that, but it's significant in terms of beaches washing away, the kind of dredging we have to do, and the washout from our vast agricultural region. We have the largest watershed in the Great Lakes that extends across three states plus Western Ontario that drains into Lake Erie. And we have to re-engineer that literally in order to handle the water that brings the nutrients down into the lake, whether those runoffs are from rural areas or from urban. It's quite a massive engineering challenge to us. One of the other threats we face is the Asian carp, and that is not a small threat. That is a huge threat. If that big head carp gets into the Great Lakes, it destroys our fishery. It destroys, really, our beaches. People will not want to fish, will not want to swim. Fishing becomes very difficult. In fact, the perch, the walleye will disappear. It's just a matter of time. So our challenge to maintain the world we've known is quite significant. And it's the type of challenge we haven't faced before, certainly not in my entire lifetime.
You say on your official website that our country's very future is at risk unless we achieve significant campaign finance reform. Please elaborate on how and why you've come to that conclusion.
Well, I have seen the Congress change so much. When I was first elected, the speakers used to go around the country and they'd come to county dinners. And they would speak to people that vote in our region. And you would get Republicans and Democrats of national stature coming here. That happens now, but only on occasion. And our local parties have weakened. And the amount of money that people at the national level are encouraged to raise for their respective parties has become almost confiscatory. There's this unwritten set of rules within the Congress that if you don't show loyalty, you know, you might not advance in your own party and take the seat that you've earned, let's say, on the committee that you've served on. That is not written in any rule, but it sort of happens. And I have seen individuals run for office, committee office from Ohio in both parties. And their seat was taken away from them by someone from the coasts because they could raise more money. And so Ohio gets hurt. Places that can't raise as much money get hurt by those places that already are doing quite well in terms of the economy and the federal government's investment. So it's really insidious. I hate it. I don't like it. I was on a bill and continue to introduce legislation to cap and to remove this kind of requirement from what members have to do, along with a gentleman who just sadly died from the state of North Carolina, Congressman Walter Jones. He was a Republican, I a Democrat. We both saw this, but you can't contain it. It just, the powers are bigger than you are.
Now, in May of this year, Fortune magazine reported the top 100 corporate political spenders turned $2 billion into $400 billion of federal contracts and tax breaks. Many observers see this and say it's capitalism that is more threatened than democracy, because the return on investment pursuing a special deal in Washington, or even Columbus for that matter, is higher and more certain than pouring money into research and development that brings us new products. In other words, in current day America, influence pays better than innovation, and both the political and business establishment appears to be just fine with that. How do we change that culture?
Well, I'll tell you, on my own committee, I can give you a current example of that. Our country is trying to develop on the defense front something called artificial intelligence. And I just learned the other day that Northern California, which has extraordinary federal investment already, is the bidder up for huge amounts of funding for artificial intelligence. And I thought, more? If they get any more, they're going to fall into the Pacific. What about our region of the country that is shortchanged by these major national labs that are involved in the development of these critical defense and energy technologies and computer-based technologies, cyber-based technologies for the next generation, you know, where we're up against the Chinese, we're up against the Russians, and particularly the Chinese in this case. And I thought, my gosh, and the individual and set of people whose names were mentioned to me, I thought, oh, they came from Wall Street, they got all their connections, so here we go again, the New York, California, San Francisco nexus. And we, both the top leader in the Democratic Party and the Republican Party in the House, come from California. In the Senate, one of the top leaders comes from New York. So it's pretty clear how power attends to those who have significant resources. And one of the things I'm doing, just so you know, I was up at the Sioux Lock in northern Michigan, the UP, the other day, and that is going to be a $1 billion construction project. And one of the questions I had was, who across Ohio, which construction firm, which organization is bidding? Are they even aware of the bids that are coming out for blasting, for concrete work, for engineering work? And we're going to do a special press announcement where we show the contract schedule so we can bring some of those dollars here and our companies can bid and can find an easy way to move toward helping on that project. That isn't really my job, but I'm concerned that others will get in line first just because they know and they've mastered the system better than our companies in Ohio that might be smaller, that might not be as big as some of these mm-hmm. giants that end up getting these contracts. So that is one way a member of Congress can try to help her constituents.
I want to delve a little deeper into the question of political culture, or maybe the question of political character. But you've been way out of step with your party and the Washington culture on a variety of issues over the years, from abortion to trade, from bank regulation to Hillary Clinton and the glass ceiling. Tell our listeners what it's like walking your own path in Washington when both political and financial power is on the other side.
You have to be tenacious. You just have to be tenacious. It's like raising a family. Good things happen, bad things happen. You have to persevere. And you're able to do enough for your region. Take the reinvestment in the automotive industry. My vote was one of the critical votes on that. And I was astounded when we had the vote to refinance the auto industry. All the money was paid back with interest over time to the government of the United States. But there were only 243 votes cast in favor. I thought there would have been 382 or 390 votes. And I had worked that issue. I mean, I worked as hard as anybody on that, and I thought, whoa, look at this. And I realized the resentment that other parts of the country had toward the automotive industry for a whole variety of reasons. So I guess, again, you persevere. You try to put the magic number of 218 together, whether it is to pass legislation to improve health care for the American people, whether it's to save an industry that this part of the country would have shut down. I mean, this part of the country would have been shuttered without the automotive industry. And yes, it's going to transition, it's going to transform, it's going to improve, but there's no place like it in the whole country. And you just can't shut down this supply chain. You just can't do it for the sake of the country. We couldn't conduct war without this industry being healthy. So if you look at the steel industry, all the related industries, the electronics industry that relate semiconductors, for heaven's sake, that relate to the automotive and to the tank manufacturing, the truck manufacturing in this area, you would have shut down America. And I saw the narrowness of that vote. Just a few dozen votes could have switched. It was breathtaking, really. So you just persevere because your people motivate you. The importance of the issue motivates you, and you can win sometimes.
So let's talk about gerrymandering, or drawing districts in a manner designed to deprive voters of significant competition. But I want to broaden the issue out and look at the self-gerrymandering of tribal clusters in Ohio. There's no large urban county in Ohio with any significant Republican political presence in city or county government. In the rural areas, the situation is exactly the opposite, and Republicans rule state government. There's little effective competition in Ohio government at any level. We're seeing what happens when Google and Facebook make the rules and have no competition or regulation. But really, the same thing's happening every day all over Ohio, and except for the congressional districts, it hasn't even been raised as a concern. Shouldn't we be concerned about the lack of competition in Ohio politics at city, county, and state level as well?
We should be very, very concerned. And this was done starting in the mid-90s, where computers drew the districts as though communities didn't matter. And I was quite surprised in Ohio, which is a tradition of home rule, where community really matters, that when gerrymandering occurred and our communities were cracked, like the district I represent, two-thirds of Toledo isn't in the district. Toledo's my home. Half of Parma was taken out of the district. Lorain County was splintered into shreds among several congressional districts. Cuyahoga County, which I also represent now, Erie County, Ottawa County, the bottom two-thirds was cut out. It's like, are you kidding me? And the natural economic region of Greater Toledo was hacked up. And I thought, how does this help us? It makes it so difficult to represent the region because your attention is divided up and each little piece, you know, is a part of a bigger whole, and it shows a lack of respect. But the reason they did it was to gain control, largely one-party control now, in Ohio, out of 16 congressional seats in a state that votes 50-50. It voted for President Barack Obama. It voted for President Trump. They, rather than having eight seats and eight seats, which would be fair, you know, you're going to Jimmy Ricket somehow, but anyway, or John, what do they call it, Johnny Ricket, somehow. We have 12 and 4, 12 Republican, 4 Democrat. And so the Democratic voices are suppressed, and they've been suppressed for well over a decade, and they've done that in 24 states, two dozen states. So you say, why doesn't Congress function? Well, because half the voices are suppressed. And it makes it doubly hard for a member like myself. If there are only 4 Democrats and 12 Republicans, that means we have to speak twice as much. We have to get on the floor twice as much to bring the issues forward because we don't have the numbers that should be there to represent all of the interests of Ohio.
Both political party nominating conventions produced a platform that included restoration of Glass-Steagall's ban on speculative trading by FDIC-insured banks. You introduced legislation to bring back the wall between consumer banks and investment banks, but the wall between banking and speculating has less progress than the wall between the United States and Mexico. Why?
That's political and economic power, to the detriment of the American people. I tried very, very hard to make sure that the big banks were under a different set of rules. If they're speculating, which they do, then fine, let them do that, but not bring down the entire economy. And I wanted to have banks that were conservative banks, that managed the people's money wisely, that didn't put the entire economic system at risk. I still believe that very, very much. And I ran into the head of J.P. Morgan Chase on the elevator in Washington, and he remembered me because I gave him a piece of my mind at one point. And I sort of looked at him working the halls of Congress, and I thought, wow, you're back again. and the people back home don't have that kind of power. But for me, but for my vote. And we can't get our bill moved out of.
But it must poll well. I mean, both parties had it front and center at their presidential nominating conventions.
The American people know. Even here in the greater Toledo area, we have so many homes that are still underwater. They are, they owe, the people owe more on their mortgage than the home is worth, and in the market. And Wall Street did that to us, and they never really compensated the American people back for what they took away. And they still haven't. They do a lot of publicity, and boy, they work the halls of Congress. Woo! And they work the members on the Financial Services Committee very heavily, and give, you know, campaign contributions and all the rest. So, and they seek to put people on those committees who agree with them already. And it's truly unfortunate for the country. So I thank those financial institutions that are responsible, that help small business thrive in our region, that treat their customers with respect, and don't get into this kind of wild behavior that in the end brings the country down.
Now, you recently got the Davis-Besse Nuclear Power Plant in Oak Harbor a federal grant to produce hydrogen as a new energy alternative for the nuclear power industry and a new economic lifeline to the plants that are like Davis-Besse. Is the hydrogen opportunity big enough to keep the plants going without a subsidy from Ohio's utility consumers?
I would say, to answer your second question, no. $9 million for hydrogen production is not sufficient to keep the...
No, not the grant, but the hydrogen opportunity,
oh, the
space.
Hydrogen opportunity. The hydrogen opportunity is enormous for our country. And the funding that Davis-Besse competed for and won will be the first experiment in the country to actually use nuclear power through a process to produce hydrogen. If we look at the natural gas discoveries in this region, the largest on the continent, and we look at the opportunities for industries to spin off of that opportunity, chemical industries, plastics industries, materials industries, and frankly, in my opinion, the automotive industry, because hydrogen is going to be sort of the third frontier. Right now we're into conventionally fueled vehicles, we're moving into electric vehicles, and hydrogen lies beyond that curve. It's further into the future, and believe me, the Chinese and the Japanese are working very hard at trying to create a hydrogen-fueled fleet. We have to do that too. So I'm hoping that we're able to move it into the transportation sector. The Davis-Besse investment will probably yield 1 to 3 megawatts a year compared to the plant itself, which is upwards of about 900 megawatts. But it's really important because we could wed hydrogen to natural gas, to obviously other energy alternatives across this region. And cryogenic hydrogen, which is a hydrogen that one cools, is used by our nuclear navy for different purposes. So we can be a place where the hydrogen economy of the future is rooted, and First Energy has to take us there. So I think that this partnership with one of our national labs, the Idaho National Lab, is extraordinarily important for us. It's, I wouldn't say it's a first base hit. I would say right now it's a bunt, but it's a step along the way to competing globally in a growing marketplace.
You've called on congressional leadership to make the opioid epidemic and the fentanyl overdose deaths a national priority. Do you see any parallels to the banking crisis in that some big businesses have gotten rich off of this and the little people are ruined?
Yes. You see many of these companies being taken to court now that have promoted certain types of pharmaceuticals that have addicted people. They continue to sell some of these products. I've been shocked in visiting people in the hospital, some of what I've learned. And so I'm glad that they've gone to court. The pharmaceutical industry is very powerful, far too powerful in and of itself, in my opinion. And it looks like this legal route is going to yield some benefits to the American people. But it's another example of what you've said. When too few have power over too many, very bad things can happen to the country. And yes, then we have to change course, but at what cost? What cost to people? the numbers of deaths, the millions of people that have died, the numbers of people who are addicted, the cost to society in terms of crime, in terms of our first responders and what they have to deal with, to the prison system. Oh my goodness, it's a very heavy load to bear. It's a crushing load.
You supported Bernie Sanders over Hillary Clinton in the last presidential nomination campaign. Are you still with Bernie, or do you have a new favorite in the 2020 race?
Well, there were only a couple candidates last time on my side of the aisle. I'd served with Bernie, and I knew some of his positions, particularly on economic growth and development. He and I share a point of view on the big banks and trying to rein them in and allow other financial institutions a greater footing in our economy and so forth. I don't agree with him on some of his positions, but I thought he would add energy into our party, and he has done that. This time there are so many that I'm reserving my endorsement. I think right now in our country we face a critical moment where we have to assure our allies, our closest allies, that we are in support of them. The current president we have has raised doubts in many quarters. I'm a very strong supporter of the NATO alliance and of the international institutions that exist to protect the people of this country. And so I want stability at our Department of Defense. I want stability at our Department of Energy. I want stability at the State Department. And so I think we need someone who is very skilled in global relations and who understands the federal government intimately. I've served a new president when Jimmy Carter was elected. I know what it's like to serve in a first-term White House. It's quite dynamic, but not always settled. And so I think I am weighing the experience of the candidates in my party very carefully. I do not support this president's lack of ability to have a Secretary of Defense in place, secretaries of the Army, Navy, and Air Force in place. Not acting, in place. And the same at the State Department. Too much confusion, too much exiting by people. That is very dangerous.
It seems like, and just real quickly here, that our choice is either return to normalcy, which, you know, kind of the Warren Harding slogan of the 20s, or big, bold, sweeping change. And you're kind of have a foot in both camps here.
I do.
With how do you decide?
We'll see how this goes. On my side of the aisle, the candidates are coming to Westerville, Ohio, very soon to Otterbein College, and we'll see what they say and what they do. But America's at a critical point. I can't tell you how many ambassadors I meet with, how much time I spend on trying to repair misunderstandings, trying to work on my defense committee to plus up certain accounts. The administration just released the money for Ukraine, for heaven's sake. Which has been invaded by Russia. Over 14,000 people have died. They are cyber warring every single nation in Europe. They're trying to create chaos there and here. This is serious. They are not a friend to our system of governance. And it is very troubling to me that we are facing this while we have the Chinese very, very aggressive, trying to steal our technologies and so forth, and creating quite a lot of pressure in Africa and other countries. There are things that are happening around the world that bear down on America. Even though, yes, we live here and we have our comfort zone in the area that we live in, but that comfort zone can only exist if the politics around it that are global are better ordered. And I think right now there's a lot of instability in that. And that is very dangerous to our country.
Congresswoman Kaptur, I want to thank you for your candor and your access. We've talked about political culture extensively, and I can tell our listeners that the new normal in public life is to release written statements or tweets and avoid extended discussion like we've just finished. So once again, I appreciate your willingness to appear on In Focus here on 107.7 The Wolf.
Thank you, John, very much, and thank your listeners for caring about this beloved country.